Have you ever been sitting in a perfectly quiet room, maybe just trying to read or relax, and someone nearby just starts chewing a piece of gum?
Oh, yeah. Or like eating an apple loudly.
Right, exactly. And suddenly, out of nowhere, you feel this overwhelming, just inexplicable surge of absolute
It's
rage.
like a visceral reaction.
Yes, or maybe it's like a dripping faucet. You hear that faint, rhythmic plink, plink, clink of water hitting the sink, or the ticking of a wall clock, and your skin literally starts to crawl.
Your chest tightens up.
Yeah, your chest tightens, your heart starts to pound, and you're just sitting there thinking, why am I so angry right now?
Well, I mean, most people experience a minor annoyance and just kind of tune it out. But for a specific subset of the population, tuning it out is, well, it's biologically impossible.
Wow.
Yeah, the brain doesn't just register an annoyance, it registers an active visceral threat.
And that feeling of threat is exactly what we are pulling apart today. We are doing a deep dive into some really groundbreaking research out of Florida Atlantic University to explore the hard biological reality of this condition.
Such an important topic.
It really is. Our mission today is to understand the physical neurology behind this intense sound sensitivity. We want to look at the honestly devastating impact it has on a person's ability to learn and function, and examine this fascinating study by Dr. Ali A. Dinesh on how the academic world is, or I guess isn't, handling it.
Yeah, this is a conversation that is long overdue because historically, I mean, society has just brushed this off.
Oh, completely.
We tell people they're just being picky or overly dramatic or that they just need to, get over.
Just ignore it, right?
Exactly. But the research we're looking at clearly defines what is actually happening. So the clinical term is misophonia.
Misophonia.
Right. And it's classified as a decreased sound tolerance disorder. This basically means specific sounds, often sounds that have a specific repetitive pattern or meaning, like chewing or breathing. They trigger intense emotional or physiological reactions.
Okay, so it's not just every loud noise.
No, not at all. The core defining feature here is that this is driven by a heightened autonomic nervous system response. It's not a choice.
Okay, let's unpack this because calling it a decreased sound tolerance disorder feels a bit like, I don't know, calling a hurricane a breezy day.
That's a great way to put it.
Right, because when I look at the physiological data measured in these patients, it sounds less like a pet peeve and more like your brain's internal fire alarm just gets pulled simply because someone across the room opened a bag of chips.
Yeah.
You're not just annoyed, your body is preparing for a literal disaster.
The clinical measurements back up that fire alarm analogy completely. I mean, the autonomic nervous system is the part of your body that handles the involuntary functions.
Like the stuff you don't even think about.
Exactly, like your heart rate and your fight or flight response.
Oh.
When a person with misophonia hears a trigger sound, their autonomic nervous system just goes into overdrive.
So what does that actually look like for them?
Well, patients report feeling immense physical pressure in their chest, a heavy tightness in their arms and their head.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, their heart rate spikes immediately. Their core body temperature actually elevates. They report experiencing genuine physical pain and a sudden difficulty in breathing.
Wait, I want to pause on one of the symptoms listed here in the study, muscle contraction.
Yeah.
Are we saying that if someone like clears their throat, a person with misophonia might have their muscles physically involuntarily flex?
Yes, absolutely. The body is literally bracing for impact. And what's fascinating here is the underlying neurology driving that reaction, like the actual neural basis of the condition.
Because they can see this happening now, right?
Right. Researchers aren't just taking patients' words for it anymore. They are putting them into functional MRI machines and watching their brains process these sounds in real time.
That is wild.
It is. And when individuals with misophonia hear their specific trigger sounds, the scans show greatly exaggerated, bold responses in a very specific area of the brain called the anterior insular cortex, or the AIC.
Okay, so an exaggerated bold response, just so we're all on the same page. Bold D stands for blood oxygen level dependent. What does that actually look like on a brain scan?
So think of the brain like a highly complex engine, right? And blood is the fuel.
Okay.
A bold response basically means we can literally see blood rushing to a specific part of the brain on the scan. That area is consuming massive amounts of oxygen and glucose because it is working in absolute overdrive.
Got it.
So when a trigger sound happens, the fuel suddenly floods into the anterior insular cortex.
And what does the anterior insular cortex actually do on like a normal quiet Tuesday?
The AIC is a massive regulatory hub. It handles interoception, yeah, which is your brain's ability to perceive your own internal bodily sensations, like feeling your own heartbeat or, you know, your lungs expanding.
Okay, so internal awareness.
Exactly. It also processes very strong primal emotions, specifically anger, disgust, and empathy.
Mm-hmm.
But crucially, it regulates something called salience.
Salience.
Right. Salience is the mechanism your brain uses to decide what things in your chaotic environment are important enough to demand your conscious attention.
Ah, so it's essentially the bouncer at the club of your conscious mind.
That is a brilliant way to look at it, yes.
Yeah.
On a normal day, for a person without misophonia, the bouncer completely ignores the dripping faucet or the ticking clock.
It's just background noise.
Exactly. It's not on the VIP list, so it doesn't get into your conscious awareness.
But with misophonia, the bouncer's criteria are just totally breaking. He's letting in the sound of someone chewing a piece of gum, slapping a VIP badge on it, and clearing the entire dance floor so your brain is forced to pay attention to nothing else.
That's exactly it. And once that sound is on the dance floor, it hijacks the limbic system, which is our deep emotional brain.
Which explains the anger and panic.
Right. And the research points out a very telling neural similarity between misophonia and tinnitus. You know, that constant ringing in the ears.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, both of these conditions heavily involve non-auditory brain areas. The sound enters the ear normally, but it's the emotional, salience, and interoceptive centers of the brain that inappropriately grab onto that signal, amplify it, and force the body into a state of panic or rage.
Which completely explains the chest pressure and the spiked heart rate. The brain is quite literally sounding a false alarm.
Exactly.
So if this is a hardwired physiological response, like a structural difference in how the brain routes information, who is most likely to have this faulty wiring?
Well, the demographic data is still kind of evolving because the diagnostic criteria are relatively new. But the numbers we do have from a major U.S. tinnitus and hyperacusis center, they estimate that about 3% of the general population suffers from misophonia.
Okay, hold on. 3% of the general population is tens of millions of people.
It's a lot.
If you are listening to this right now on a bus or in a cafe, there is a very high statistical probability that someone in the room with you has this condition.
Without a doubt. And the numbers get even more concentrated when you look at specific groups.
Like who?
Well, for patients who already suffer from a generally low tolerance to sound, a staggering day, 92% of them also have misophonia.
Wow.
But the overlaps with other neurodivergent conditions are where it gets truly revealing. For instance, 90% of individuals with Williams syndrome, which is a rare genetic neurodevelopmental disorder, they show greater sensitivity to specific sounds.
90%.
Yeah. And 27% of individuals with autism spectrum disorder experience this as well.
That level of overlap really points to something deeply rooted in how the brain develops, which naturally brings up the question of origins. I mean, is this something you're born with? Does a traumatic event trigger it? And, you know, if you have it, are you going to pass it down to your kids?
Good questions. The research looked at a large-scale study of 300 participants to track the timeline, and a very clear pattern emerged. For the vast majority of people, the symptoms first appear in childhood or during their early teenage years.
Okay, so it starts young.
It does. And perhaps the most difficult aspect of this condition is that the severity of the misophonic responses tends to increase over time.
Wait, it gets worse.
Yeah, it doesn't naturally fade away as you get older. The neural pathways seem to just get more entrenched.
Man, that's rough. And as for where it comes from, if it starts in childhood and correlates heavily with genetic disorders like Williams syndrome, there has to be a DNA component, right?
There is a very strong genetic indication. Anecdotally, patients using commercial DNA testing kits have started to find commonalities.
Really? Like 23andMe kind of stuff?
Exactly. Researchers have identified mutations on chromosome 5. They're looking closely at a gene called 10NM2. Which is heavily involved in the development of the brain's neural networks.
Okay.
It's located at a specific cytogenic coordinate, which is 5Q34.
So we aren't just talking about a psychological quirk here. There is a literal mapped genetic coordinate associated with this condition.
Exactly.
If you are listening to this and realizing you've had these intense reactions since you were 12 years old, it's not because you have a bad temper. It might literally be written into your DNA on chromosome 5.
And that neurodevelopmental origin perfectly explains the high rates of comorbidity we see. The data shows misophonia frequently co-occurs with ADHD, obsessive compulsive disorder, PTSD, and various mood disorders.
Because it's all connected.
Right. The brain's regulatory networks are intricately linked, so a variation in one area often cascades into others.
So brain scans, genetic markers, and autonomic nervous system data are crucial, obviously. But what does this actually look like when a person tries to navigate the real world?
It's incredibly difficult.
I mean, you have a condition that starts in childhood, gets progressively worse as you age, physically hijacks your attention, and forces your body into an intense state of fight or flight. It seems inevitable that this is going to violently collide with any environment that demands quiet focus.
Oh, absolutely.
Like an office building or a university lecture hall.
It creates an almost impossible environment because if your anterior insular cortex cannot filter out the trigger stimulus, you simply cannot refocus your attention on the professor or the exam paper or the board meeting.
It's all you can hear.
The trigger sound becomes entirely all-consuming.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the research from Dr. Dinesh brings in actual case studies that show the real-world devastation of this condition.
Yeah, the case studies are heartbreaking.
One of the primary motivations for this specific research was a 24-year-old male patient. This young man had OCD and a very rare condition called palynacusis.
Right, and palynacusis is a fascinating and deeply challenging auditory illusion where sounds persist or echo in a person's mind long after the actual acoustic noise has stopped.
Let's really think about what that means for a second. This young man felt all noises were magnified, but his specific triggers for misophonia were things like birds chirping, ticking clocks, beeping sounds, the sound of rain, faucet drops, the bass line of music, and mouth noises, even his own chewing.
So many everyday sounds.
Now combine that with palynacusis. A bird chirps outside the window. The sound stops, but his brain keeps playing the tape of that chirp on an endless loop. And every time it echoes in his mind, his body's fire alarm gets pulled again.
It is a loop of biological distress. The environment became so hostile to his nervous system, the acoustic landscape of getting an education became so overwhelming that he actually left school. He dropped out.
And he isn't the only one. The research details a second case study of a mother of two. She developed severe sound sensitivity after suffering a head trauma during a horse riding accident when she was a child.
Which highlights that while there's a genetic component, physical trauma to the brain's regulatory centers can also initiate or exacerbate the condition.
Right, it can be acquired. Her triggers were the general ambient noise of a classroom, the chewing sounds of her spouse, and certain pitches of voices. And just like the young man, the physical toll of sitting in a room with these sounds was so severe that she, too, abandoned her education.
It's incredibly sobering.
People are giving up their futures because they are biologically trapped in a room with a ticking clock. But for people without the condition, there's often a real lack of empathy. They wonder why the person can't just, you know, tough it out and focus on the math test.
To understand why toughing it out is biologically impossible, the research includes a historical anecdote that I think puts the sheer force of this distraction into perspective.
Oh, the Churchill one.
Yes, it involves Winston Churchill during World War II.
The Churchill War Rooms. When I saw this in the source material, it completely reframed the whole issue for me.
Winston Churchill had a profound, documented hatred of noise distractions, particularly whistling. He despised it so much that deep underground in the war rooms, the very place where the most critical, high-stress, life-or-death decisions of the entire global conflict were being made, he had a paper sign pinned up in the corridors explicitly banning whistling or unnecessary noise. A direct order from the Prime Minister. No whistling while we fight the war.
Exactly. But he went even further than a sign. The standard typewriters used by the secretaries in that era had a loud, rhythmic clacking sound.
Very distinctive sound.
Churchill's brain could not filter it out. It was so disruptive to his concentration that he forced his staff to use specially adapted typewriters imported all the way from the United States, the Remington noiseless typewriters.
It really puts it in perspective. I mean, if a world leader with limitless resources managing global war couldn't just tune out the sound of a typewriter, how on earth is a 19-year-old college student supposed to tune out a classmate loudly chewing gum during a 2-hour chemistry final? They can't. The biological drive of the insular cortex is simply too strong to overcome with just willpower. And that brings us to the core issue of the Florida Atlantic University research.
Right.
We know people are dropping out of college because of this. We know the biology behind it. So how are the universities themselves responding to this invisible crisis?
So what does this all mean for the students right now? The researchers set out to measure the actual awareness and responsiveness among academics. They conducted a survey of faculty members who instruct undergraduate courses across six major Florida universities.
That's a big sample.
Yeah, we're talking about Florida Atlantic University, the University of Florida, UNF, UCF, Florida Gulf Coast University, and Florida International University, a massive sample size of the academic environment.
And the data they uncovered presents a very jarring paradox. We mentioned earlier that about 3% of the general population has this.
Yeah.
However, previous studies cited in the research suggest that up to 20% of undergraduate students self-report experiencing clinical signs of misophonia.
Wait, hold on. We need to look at that discrepancy. The national average is estimated around 3%, but 20% of college students are reporting clinical signs.
Yes.
That's 1 in 5 students. Is the condition suddenly exploding in young people, or is something else going on here?
It's a crucial question. While diagnostics are tricky, it is highly likely that the extreme high-stress environment of a university, you know, the lack of sleep, the pressure of exams, the crowded lecture halls, acts as a pressure cooker that exacerbates underlying genetic traits.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
Yeah, a student who might have had a mild, manageable sensitivity at home suddenly finds their nervous system completely overwhelmed in a 300-person lecture hall.
The stress just lowers the threshold for the fire alarm.
Exactly.
But here is the other half of that paradox. If 20% of students are experiencing these symptoms, Dr. Dinesh's survey revealed that only 18.4% of the faculty across those six universities even knew what the word misophonia meant.
Less than 1 in 5 professors had ever heard of the condition.
That's wild.
And the real tragedy is in the accommodation data. Out of all those faculty members surveyed, a mere 2.3% reported ever having a student actually request an accommodation for sound sensitivity.
That gap is massive. If 20% are suffering, but only 2% are asking their professors for help, there is a systemic breakdown in communication.
A huge breakdown.
These students are suffering in silence, internalizing the blame, failing their classes, or dropping out entirely because they don't think anyone will believe them. What is the solution here?
Well, the study revealed one incredibly optimistic finding that points directly to the solution. The researchers found that the faculty members who did have prior knowledge of misophonia were significantly more likely to agree that the condition should be taken seriously.
Oh, that's good news.
They were much more willing to consider changing their own classroom behaviors and allowing accommodations compared to the professors who were completely in the dark.
So the empathy is actually there. The professors aren't trying to be cruel. They are perfectly willing to help. They just literally do not know the problem exists.
Right. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the absolute key to fixing this academic disconnect is the dissemination of information. Awareness is the prerequisite for accommodation.
You can't fix what you don't know about.
Exactly. Ugh. If a professor sees a student suddenly stand up and flee the room during a quiet exam, their default assumption might be that the student is cheating or being disrespectful or having a panic attack.
Sure.
But if that professor understands misophonia, they recognize it as an involuntary autonomic response to a trigger sound. The entire dynamic changes from discipline to support.
It changes from a behavioral issue to an accessibility issue. And the research actually lays out a clear, structured framework for how universities can accommodate these students once the awareness is there. They utilize the World Health Organization's concepts of disability to categorize the issue so academic institutions know how to process it.
The WHO framework is incredibly useful here, because it breaks the subjective experience down into 3 actionable steps. First, there's the impairment. In this case, the impairment is a biological body function, the misophonia itself, the hyperactive insular cortex.
Right, the physical broken hardware.
Exactly. That impairment directly leads to the second step, which is limitations. These are limitations in activities, such as the sudden, catastrophic inability to concentrate on a task.
And that leads to the final step.
Restrictions. Restrictions in participation. Because the student cannot concentrate, they fail the class, or they're restricted from participating in their education entirely and drop out.
By mapping it out this way, it fits perfectly into how a university disability office operates. The research outlines the specific process used at Florida Atlantic University as a model. A student doesn't have to just walk up to a professor after class and beg for a favor.
Right, that can be so intimidating.
Totally. Instead, they submit formal documentation to the university's accessibility office. Once approved, they are assigned an accessibility coordinator.
And that coordinator sits down with the student for an interactive, collaborative meeting. This is vital because misophonia is highly individualized. They tailor specific, reasonable accommodations based entirely on what triggers that specific student.
Because one student's trigger might be a ticking clock, while another's is the sound of keyboard typing. The accommodations have to match the trigger.
Precisely.
One student might simply need permission to wear noise-canceling headphones during a written exam. Another might require a completely separate, isolated testing environment. Or, crucially, they might just need formal permission to leave the lecture hall without academic penalty if a trigger sound becomes too overwhelming.
Giving them that permission, that safety valve, actually gives them their education back. It stops the cycle of biological distress leading to academic failure.
It is a profound shift in how we handle sensory environments. Let's bring all of this together because we've covered a massive amount of ground today.
We really have.
For everyone listening, whether you experience this yourself or know someone who does, the main takeaway is this. Misophonia is not a quirky dislike of chewing sounds. It is not someone being overly sensitive. It is a documented neurological condition where everyday acoustic sounds literally hijack the brain's limbic system and anterior insular cortex.
It's biological.
It pulls the body's fire alarm, causing genuine physical distress and massive disruptions in a person's ability to function. But as the data from the Florida University shows, the ultimate antidote in the academic and professional world is simply awareness.
That is the most actionable insight we can walk away with. Whether you are a university student, a professor, a manager, or just someone sharing a desk in an open plan office, your understanding of this condition really matters.
It makes a huge difference.
It does. If a colleague has a severe, seemingly disproportionate reaction to your clicking pen, recognizing that it is a biological response and not a personal attack on you completely changes how you interact. Empathy requires knowledge, and a little bit of knowledge can change an entire environment.
It turns frustration into compassion, and it leaves us with a fascinating, slightly unsettling thought to carry forward.
Oh.
We've spent this time exploring how a sound as simple, mundane, and quiet as a ticking clock or a dripping faucet can completely invisibly hijack the human brain's regulatory systems. It really makes you wonder, if our neurology can be manipulated so powerfully by something so small, what other hidden sensory triggers in our modern, artificially constructed environments are secretly draining our attention, spiking our heart rates, and shaping our behaviors every single day without us ever even realizing it?
Wow, that is a profound question about how our ancient brains are surviving in a modern world.
Something for you to mull over the next time you find yourself sitting in a perfectly quiet room.